Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 158, Science Fiction as Sadhana, Buddhist Inner Sciences 101.
Retired from active teaching at Columbia. And that's a big, I didn't think of it as a big thing because I'm still on the faculty for a little while longer. But it is a big thing. You know, I felt very sentimental. On my final class of my introductory course, about 70 students, it's dropped down from earlier years due to various things and it's building up again, actually. But I can't stay, so that's that. And anyway, in the last class, they brought cakes. They brought balloons to the classroom. And then at the end of the lecture or of the day's class, they informed me that they had planned to spend the day telling me about the different insights that they had had during the year. But then when I started teaching, then they just let me teach. So, but then I was embarrassed and I said, well, if you told me, I would have stopped and listened to you. And then they said, no, we enjoyed the last thing. And what I did was I went over the Man of Peace book. Because the last book that they read was the Dalai Lama's Beyond Religion, Ethics for the New Millennium. And I was showing them the Dalai Lama's own struggle with the unethics of the Chinese communists and the military and the whole thing. And I showed that book, you know. I went through some of the pages of it to them and they were really thrilled. And my most fun experience of that party was a young Chinese man, very marvelous one, who plans to be an astrophysicist, he told me on that last day. He had not spoken to me during the semester, but on the last day, he suddenly burst into smiles, especially when he saw the book, the comic book of Man of Peace. And he just rushed up and he said how much he enjoyed the course and how much he learned from it and all this. And then he told me his name, and then I gave him the source of his name in the Tao Te Ching, the Book of the Way, you know. And it was wonderful because he's a very serious student type. And all semester long, he had not really cracked a smile. He was a gung-ho listening, like a very, very, very severe concentration. So that really made my week. On that last day, the spy from the Confucius Institute didn't show up, who had been attending my early lectures, although maybe I converted him a little bit, I don't know, but he didn't want to come to the last lecture on the Dalai Lama. It's in my essence of eloquence, translation and study of the Dalai Lama's greatest, not the Dalai Lama, Dalai Lama's teacher, Dzongkhapa, his greatest treatise on emptiness and on the mind-only school, you know, the Vijnanavada school, the consciousness school, and the centrist school. Really amazing book. You know, it's called the Iron Bow of Dzongkhapa, or sometimes called the Golden Book of Dzongkhapa, because of a vision that Dzongkhapa had. I don't know if Michael told you that story. When Dzongkhapa was writing another source that you could read, although it wasn't translated by me, so maybe, but whatever, I won't go into that. It's in the third volume of the three-volume Great Lamrim Chemo, which I recommend to you all, edited by Joshua Cutler. I wrote one of the forewords, and unfortunately I was not part of the translation team due to politics, but it's still pretty good. And when he was doing the wisdom part of that, the Vipassana part of that, Laktong part of that, you know, critical insight part of that, he was discouraged about it because it's so complex and subtle, and he was going to give up writing it even. He got sort of writer's block, and And then Manjushri appeared to him, or he had his usual conversation with Manjushri that he used to regularly have. And he said to Manjushri, why am I bothering to write? Who am I writing this for? No one's going to really appreciate this level of subtlety of the people around me among my students. And Manjushri said, what are you telling me about who's going to appreciate what? In the future, this will be a great book. You go ahead and finish it. And then to encourage him, Manjushri, sorry about my hair, but everybody lost all the hairbrushes. Manjushri created a vision in the sky at his retreat house where he was writing that. It was in Retting Monastery, the monastery founded by Dhomdhampa, the disciple of Atisha, who was the first Dalai Lama incarnation of Avalokiteshvara in Tibet, according to the tradition. Dhomdhampa, his name. And layman, actually, layman, but Atisha's principal disciple. And that's where he wrote Lam Rim Chimo, and Dzongkhapa did. And then he said, but the letters were in silver. So he looked all for the months he took writing that, or letters of the 20 emptinesses from the Prajnaparamita written in silver in the sky, in Sanskrit, and too. So those are all worthy of reading. But I'm very glad that Michael did that. And I could do another session myself on that book. And I'm more happy to do it now that I retired and I have no one to teach anymore. And I'm enjoying teaching you. So what I thought I would do today, just to leave you with it, I'll be away all of January pretty much. And so I won't be able to make another thing. And although I understand not too many of you are consulting this work, which I'm sad to know. You know, I guess everyone is very busy, and I hope you're keeping up your sadhana practice, and I hope you will come to the retreat, which is now moved to later in February, I think, during the New Year fortnight, so very auspicious. So what I'm going to do today, I think, is I'm going to read from our beloved Vesna Wallace's translation. And give some commentary on the sadhana chapter, just to warm you up, which I think we'll look at quite a bit during the retreat. It's the fourth chapter, you know, because, right, you have the outer, inner, that's the first and the second chapters, then the alternative Kala Chakra, outer Kala Chakra, inner Chakra, then the alternative Kala Chakra are the last three chapters of the light tantra or abridged tantra, and its commentary, the stainless light, written by Dalai Lama's previous Avalokiteshvara incarnation, the Pundarika, the White Lotus, eighth king of Shambhala, according to the magical tradition. Okay, so she begins. It's called the Great Exposition. Well, there, each of the Kala Chakra chapters are divided in the commentary to different what are called great expositions. And actually, that's a laconic translation, because the literal word udesha means a summary exposition, sort of mean concise exposition. But the great exposition, the great summary exposition on the location, protection, and disclosure of sins, it begins. Because, of course, any sadhana involves a process of purification and of empowerment or fortification, right? It's the fourth chapter, the initiation, the sadhana, and then the perfection stage. So this is the creation stage. It's 3, 4, 5, chapter 3, 4, 5, like that. So I'm beginning with, these are the verses now by Pundarika, which means Dalai Lama's previous life as a king of Shambhala, in my opinion. I always, when I worked on this, editing these texts, the four chapters that we've done, as I would get into the Sanskrit and the Tibetan of these different chapters, in editing the great translations of Vesna Wallace, Jensine Andreessen, and James Hartzell, last two being students of mine, Vesna not being my student, just a colleague, I always hear Dalai Lama's voice coming from Pundarika. It comes just like his voice, I don't know why. Now, the word Bhagavan, which is the name of Buddha, Vesna changed from just using Bhagavan to using, at my suggestion and with the agreement of Alan Wallace, her husband, also a translator, she translated it as Divine Lord, which I think is quite nice, actually. for Bhagavan, because it is like talking to God, you know, when you use the word Bhagavan and you address a Buddha, and you say Bhagavan, you're kind of indicating that a Buddha is, although a Buddha seems to be a human, he's also called teacher of humans and gods, and he's sometimes called the god of the gods. These are all classical names of Buddha, Devati Deva, Purusha Deva Manushanam Shasta, and there's something divine about him. You know, he's like, I would say a Buddha is like Dr. Spock in the transporter beam room of the newer generation Star Treks, when he's being beamed out somewhere just before his form disappears, with sparkles of light inside his body and the body itself looking kind of vague. I would say that's what Buddha looked like once he was Buddha. Sort of just not ordinary, in other words, meat space body, a kind of a divine or a Buddhine. If we had a word Buddhine, that would be good, but a meat space body. So there's something very, very divine-like about Buddha. We do use divine. Oh, that's absolutely divine, people say. Oh, how do you like that? Oh, it's divine, you know. Okay, so now I'm going to quote the verses and make a little commentary on them. Pundarika begins, of course, homage to glorious Kalachakra. Unruly beings always see the form of the divine Lord sprung from merit and knowledge as a fearsome Bhairava, while good people see it as free of conceit. So here is saying that like an embodiment like Kalachakra, a wild and savage being or unruly one sees it as frightening. They're afraid of a Buddha. But the good people, they see it as somehow normal, with no airs. You know, they somehow see it, they don't fear it, which is kind of an interesting way to begin. That's really interesting. In a way, I think it's because a Buddha is not there for himself, as we've often talked about, but just to remind you why people are so moved by the Dalai Lama, because in a way the very body is not just there for his own sake. Although he would deny that if he heard me say that in front of him, he would go, "Oh, give me a break," type of thing. But that is the case of such a high incarnation, I believe. I have that faith. So therefore there's a feel, and therefore when he meets someone, he's sort of really present with that someone. In a way, he's seeing the situation almost automatically from the other one's point of view. And so the other one feels like very close to such a person. And they don't feel a kind of resistance to their presence that we ordinary self-centered beings sort of have to each other subliminally, why we shake hands to show we don't have a weapon in the hand, why we give hugs. We're sort of trying to get out of that thing of being an opposed being who's there for itself. I'm getting my batch of the air here and you're getting yours. But a Buddha's not like that. Although they might show the form of a being that breathes, they're really there for you. So I often say, like, if a mad scientist put two beings in a time lock safe room with a time lock on the lock that there's only enough oxygen for one of them to survive, only a Buddha would be able to freely cease to breathe and consume oxygen, so the other one could survive without any effort or displeasure or freak out. A Buddha could do that by definition. An ordinary person couldn't. The altruistic person might try holding their breath, but they'd get to a level then of having sort of spasms where their body would, autonomic nervous system would grab air. But a Buddha doesn't have is not driven by any kind of unconscious impulse, an enlightened being. So that's the difference. And that's why Pundarika seeks that. And he's saying to you at the beginning of Sadhana chapter, he's saying that you need a body like that. And he also mentions sprung from merit and knowledge, because in practicing a sadhana, you are developing merit, punya, and you're developing jnana. She puts knowledge, I would call it intuition, intuitive knowledge, you know, deep kind of knowledge, you know, immediate knowledge, not conceptual knowledge. But in a way, ordinary, that is, ordinary knowledge is like that underneath the conception, so knowledge is okay. So those are the two stores that anybody collects, even if they're not doing tantric sadhana, and it takes three incalculable aeons of lifetimes for a bodhisattva without esoteric practice. And you, by doing sadhana and creation stage after initiation, you're going off meat space, whether you know it or not. When you enter into an attempt to visualize the mandala, you're leaving meat space and you're going into, not, I guess we don't say cyberspace, but you're going into mandala space. And in a way, your ability to visualize and imagine, this is really interesting, I think, this point, it gives you a different encouragement in doing it. Your ability to imagine and visualize, it's not like you're creating it, therefore. It's like you're finding it because it's there. You know, it's given to everyone. The Kala Chakra Mandala is everywhere. It's the blissed out level of it, perceiving everything. No, with no flaw, no fault, no pain. You know, all as made of bliss. It's clear light level. And so what you're visualizing is actually your way of opening your mind to that perception, using the concept to reach a conceptless experience of it, which you don't do until you get more versatile at it. So, you know, we have trouble visualizing. We say, oh, it's so terrible hard to visualize. And it is, because we are regularly visualizing, you know, ordinary things to recognize them, you know, to slap our concept on them. So we're sort of, our brain constructs the perception out of molecules, you know, photons, light that comes reflected, although, you know, seeming instantaneous because it's speed of light. And yet, you know, light, that is not, or it must be less than speed of light, because if it was speed of light, it would be everywhere, you know. We couldn't see it then. It would be, we'd just be lost in a flow of light, because it all is light. And in that, all that light, the Buddha mandalas are being maintained by the Buddhas all the time. And when they embrace us as their beloved disciple, and because we are so open to receiving, to being reborn through that initiation ceremony, as we will go through someday again, more in depth, then so when we visualize, we're recovering what actually is there at the extraordinary level, the magical, illusory, magical level. And therefore, the stronger we get about it, the more, the learning more of emptiness, so I'm so glad you all did that on the last call, the learning more about emptiness is what makes us realize the illusoriness of what we think we are perceiving as the solid world. And the more we realize the illusoriness of that, then within illusion, we can paint with the brushes of samadhi, as Ketubje says in his beautiful sadhana, long sadhana book, or mind mandala sadhana books that we have read in previous sessions. We are painting within those illusions, we're shifting, you know. That's why it's so fast. And then the merit and the knowledge accumulation. So all the offerings that you visualize in the sadhana practice, and all being, you know, appreciating of the beauty of the Buddha body and the Kala Chakra body and the building, the mandala building, and its jewel-like ornamentation and so forth. And all of that is developing merit. And our awareness of the illusoriness and the voidness of everything we see in our visualization is deepening our intuitive knowledge. And so both are being, and those deepenings are accelerating what we would normally take many, many lifetimes to gain. Of course, this is especially in the perfection stage where we simulate a death and rebirth process, death between and rebirth process. But even in the creation stage, we do that by going into the between of the sadhana session. We enter a between through imagination. It's just beautiful. It's just so cool. Okay. So unruly beings always see the form of the divine Lord, the Bhagavan, sprung from merit and knowledge as a fearsome Bhairava. That's, Bhairava means terrifier. Or I like to say terrific. And I think I'll stick with it, actually. Some people try to dissuade me. Terrific in its real meaning. While good people see it as free of conceit. That is to say, not higher, not holier than thou. Like our mother, our lover, our friend, our beloved, our brother or sister, you know. which has how the Dalai Lama always addresses everyone, sisters and brothers and sisters. Homage to him, second verse, homage to him whose speech, reaching others' hearing and endowed with all languages, points out the true path in accord with the mental dispositions of sentient beings. So here, he's praising the speech of Buddha, Bhagavan, whether in his Kalachakra form or not, it applies to any manifestation of Buddha. And the speech, of course, is the, you know, Dzongkhapa has a famous verse in his short essence of good eloquence, where he says, of all the deeds of a Buddha, the deeds of speech are supreme. Therefore, wise people praise Buddha from the point of view of their speech. And Zeba Kunle Sungini, Zeba Choyun Deyani, Dedekeva Sungne, Dumayin, I forgot the division, I'm sorry, I remember the first line. Anyway, so here the idea is that since a Buddha experiences themselves as being all the other beings to whom they are speaking at the same time as they are being the being that is the channel of speech, of Buddha speech, they therefore are completely aware of the linguistic receptivities of all of the beings, and they have this special ability or endowment that different beings will hear the Buddha in their own language. It's like the Star Trek translator computer, you know, that the automatic translator that also happens between people who meet aliens, and they automatically hear the alien in English, the alien hears them in the alien language without any effort. So the Buddha is like that. It's amazing how many things in these sci-fi films are anticipating things that are already in the Buddhist idea of what a being can become. So reaching others' hearing, endowed with all languages, points out the true path. I guess reaching, she puts an and there, and I guess meaning that, you know, without, in the days when they didn't have, you know, audio file magnification, amplification, that a Buddha had a special language ability to appear, to be seem to be right in front of anybody in a vast audience of 100,000 beings. They say, you know, there are these huge assemblies, which of course Westerners take as just, you know, pious exaggeration, but I'm sure, quite sure they're true. And everyone felt he was just right close by them. That's part of it. So he, you know, immediate in others' hearing and endowed with all languages, points out the true path in accord with the mental dispositions of beings, and or knows everybody's mental disposition, and therefore shows the one, each one, the path that is correct for that one, which will be different from different ones. That's wonderful. And now, his body that is endowed with the third verse, his body that is endowed with the best of all forms and is perceived by sentient beings in accordance with their dispositions and their respective mental states, has the characteristics of an emanation body, a nirmanakaya. So that's just a defining an emanation body, a nirmanakaya, a magical emanation. And he said, magical emanation of what? Because there is no one located body that is the Buddha, and then the others are just like dummies or projections, you know, magical projections. The Buddha is all of equally all of those projections, because a Buddha is equally all of the things he's not projecting, which are just other beings. Because a Buddha's reality body, Dharmakaya, in its highest meaning of reality itself, or Dharma's highest meaning, of the good reality, real reality, which means clear light of the void. And so that body is everything. And so a Buddha is a being who feels their body is everything in all of its specifics. And so therefore, out of the various energy, the infinite energy that is at the base, like the energy that creates or that manifests and sustains any particular being in any particular environment, there's always infinite amount of extra energy there for a Buddha. So out of the energy around that being, a Buddha can shape whatever it is that exactly interacts with that being to benefit that being in the optimal possible way. That's called nirmanakaya, body of emanation. And in a way, nirmana, mana means to magically create, and nir means going out of. So it's the same idea of it's going out of a source. But the source is not like one person is the one body hiding somewhere and being the Buddha, and then the rest are just creations of the Buddha. No, Buddha is all of the bodies and therefore can create infinite, but in Manakaya it's infinite in its ability to manifest Gangla Gandul Dela Detamba, as they say. That whatever it is that educates whomsoever, he manifests that, or she or it manifests that, whatever a Buddha is. Okay? So that's in Nirmanakaya. Then fourth verse. His body that displays its miracles. And here, Vesna gives the footnote from Bhutan, the great master, grandmaster, like grandfather teacher of Tsongkhapa, he died of only when Tsongkhapa was only 5 or 6, and still in Amdo, so they never met. I died, I think, in 6 years after Tsongkhapa was born. And so Tsongkhapa studied with Chungpo Lewa, his great student, and master of the Guhya Samaja and Yamantaka and these kind of things, called Chakra. And but Bhutan says the miracle that is meant here, even though it's in a plural, is mainly the miracle of teaching. That's the true miracle of Buddha. Manifesting bodies, visions, doing things that contravene the normal laws of gravity and things like that. Those are minor miracles. The great miracle is teaching, because teaching is what then opens the recipient of the teaching, the student, to the reality that is so glorious, that is their own reality, actually. It's not some other reality that they have to give themselves up and go become something else. It isn't that. It's the glory of their own reality. Because every being is actually made of glory, made of clear light of the void. That's it. The world is made of glory. That's what it is, according to Buddhist physics.
Thurman podcast was originally recorded for his ongoing Kali Chakra Study and Practice Group, which holds an annual retreat at Menla in Phoenicia, New York. To learn more about this online study group, please visit bobthurman.com. The group is open to all students of the Kali Chakra who have received the initiation or have attended one of the Dalai Lama's teachings on the Kali Chakra. This podcast is a part of the Buddhist Inner Sciences 101 series, taken from the Bob Thurman and Tibet House U.S. Archives, which are intended to provide an introduction to the yogic, meditative, and theoretical practices of the tradition. These recordings are intended to be a general overview, and one should be studying with a qualified teacher before attempting or engaging in any of the practices. And now back to Bob in the second half of this week's podcast.
Enjoyment body, sambhogakaya. She calls it enjoyment body. I call it beatific body. I think enjoyment is not strong enough for me. Bhoga by itself could mean enjoyment. But sambhoga, sam means total. So therefore I want a stronger word like bliss or beatitude, you know. We have from Dante and from Latin, you know, we have the idea, and the Catholic Church maintains the word beatific. And it's a person is beatific when they're filled with bliss. I think that's better. But that's the preferred enjoyment, and that's standard amongst people. because there keeps it safe. It's not too much enjoyment. It might be dangerous. So anyway, it displays its miracle. And he says, through the utterances of all sentient beings, and I'm not sure about this. Here, are they saying that the Buddha universe somehow gives speech to beings, you know, like manifests as speech from a very subtle plane, because it's through speech that beings can reach beyond themselves and connect to others by listening and speaking. And is that somehow a gift of Buddha at the subtle plane level? Because Sambhogakaya is infinite and eternal and perpetual, like the Dharmakaya, like the reality body. It's the individual Buddha's enjoyment of the reality body. So it's sort of like just vast light. It's the light in the reality of everything, or something like that. It's this differentiation between the individual being who has become a Buddha enjoying being one with all the Buddhas in the vast infinite reality body that includes everything. These are all dualistic kind of ideas in terms of language, which is dualistic, but automatically they're really said to be one thing. So the individual universal duality is collapsed in that. And yet this is showing that each Buddha gets to enjoy being one, the same as all the Buddhas. Something inconceivable like that. You know, seemingly contradictory like that. And so is that what inspires speech? You know, the whole thing, you know, the evolutionists are looking at the chimpanzee and this and that, 98% of the same genes, and then where's the gap where suddenly the brain is big and they're able to speak? And because, well, chimps speak, they make sound, but speak in words, you know, where does that come from? Is this saying that? I'm not sure. Or is this, the translation would make it seem like that. And I don't have the Sanskrit with me. So it could be meaning something very magical like that. Or it could simply mean that he gives his teachings in every language. Which is the vow of the Bodhisattva Samantabhadra, or the Buddha's universally good Buddha, Samantabhadra, that he will teach the Dharma in every language, learn every language to teach it. But Buddha automatically is every language, then it automatically gets taught or something. Maybe, I don't know. I'm not sure about that. So, but anyway, through the utterances of all sentient beings, of course, in accordance with their dispositions, each one's dispositions, that's like the similar, we already had that idea. So that's his Sambhogakaya. And that's interesting. So Sambhogakaya gets related to speech among body, speech, and mind. It's sort of subtle, like speech. It reminds me a little bit of the goddess in the Vimalakirti in the chapter where she teases Shariputra for thinking he can't say anything about nirvana because speech is too dualistic to express nirvana. And she says, do not point to nirvana by abandoning speech. The nirvana is neither outside nor inside nor anywhere in between. Neither is speech outside or inside or anywhere in between. The very nature of speech is nirvana, she says. So is the very nature of speech the beatific body of the Buddha? Is it in the vast ocean of speech of all articulate beings throughout the universe, in the many humanoid planets that exist, the infinite numbers of humanoid planets that exist in the infinite universe? I don't know if that's a claim that's being made. It's a very sci-fi claim. But the Mahayana is very sci-fi. The Buddha view of the world is very sci-fi. Or you could say that the modern tradition of sci-fi is a teaching of visualization to we humans to visualize the worlds that could be, the society that could be, either both bad and good, bad as a cautionary and good as inspirational. You could say that. So sci-fi is a sadhana for the society as a whole. Very interesting. For example, you know, Star Trek, the Klingons were the Russians. Then they kind of petered out. The Romulans were the Chinese. But Star Trek kind of like lost track there. And we had the new series in a different universe and all that. So it didn't stay so close to the U.S. political situation. But the long-term Cold War Star Trek, the Klingons were totally the Russians. And so eventually bringing Worf on board was like, citizen diplomacy with the Russians in the subliminal mind of the American people. Wouldn't you say? But we had to think of its effect on the subliminal mind of Trump, of course. Never mind. That's a joke. Remember, I think I've told you that the word dharma has 11 meanings, all the way from a thing. It can mean a simple thing. It can mean a property of an object also. It can mean a topic of discussion. At the lowest meaning of what are the bottom range of 5 or 6 meanings are what are called pattern maintaining meanings, where it can mean also duty, law, and religion, all kinds of structural things that make hold patterns, you know, because it comes from the word dirt, to hold. And those are the old pre-Buddhist meanings, pretty much, in Indian literature, dharma. But then Buddha gives it another range of 5 or 6 meanings that are what you could call pattern transcending meanings, where the holding means that reality holds us in freedom from suffering, rather than holds us in a fixed pattern of behavior like law, duty, custom, religion. You know, it's your dharma. You know, it's what they tell Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. That's the old Brahminical structural meaning. But dharma means path, where you leave something, you know, go on a path. Teaching, where you change your mind, you change your being by learning something. Truth, which makes you free. And finally, reality itself. And texts, you know, that embody that teaching and so forth, are all set of meanings where they are liberating meanings, you know, rather than residing meanings, the transcending meanings, right? So the highest one, dharma, there means reality itself, because nirvana is reality itself. That's the point. Buddhahood, nirvana, which is only full Buddhahood, is only real nirvana, is everything. Dharmakaya, therefore, you experience yourself as that everything. And it's everything as purely made of bliss. So it's no different from pure sheer bliss, sheer infinite field of glory or bliss or clear light of the void or whatever you want to call it. That's what reality body is. Which is beyond dualism and conceptualization. And he says, it's neither impermanent nor permanent. It's usually really permanent, actually, thought to be. But in a way, he's saying that means it's not impermanent. But by saying that it's not permanent, means that it contains all impermanence, in a sense. So it is all of this, non-dual from all of the impermanent things. So therefore, the duality of impermanent and permanent, in other words, when it's everything, although it's always been the case and always will be, the reality body of the Buddha, it nevertheless is, in that sense, the meaning permanent has no meaning when there's no impermanent. And therefore, it is all the impermanent things. It's like emptiness is not a space within which things are, like space. It is the things themselves in their relativity. So it's absolute relativity. So the relative, all relational things in being relational are absolute. It's that sort of thing, right? So that's why they say not permanent. Neither thing. I tried to help Deepak with that, telling him, don't say it's all mind. You know, the Vedanta tends to more be influenced by Vijnanavada. Both Vijnanavada, the consciousness school, and a philosophy of Mahayana Buddhism, and the centrist philosophy of Mahayana Buddhism, which incorporates all the good of the consciousness school, but makes it more accessible, you could say. So it's not against it, you know, although it could be an individual way of holding it. But both of them influence Vedanta. So Vedanta completely comes out of them rather than comes out of the Vedas. It comes out of them. And neither single nor characterized as many. So not one, not many. In other words, that's what they say in the exoterically in the Mahayana Sutra Alankara, the universal vehicle discourse literature, as I call it, or the ornament of the universal vehicle, sutras. He says that we never say there's only one Buddha, we never say there are many Buddhas, At the reality body level, there's no difference between all the Buddhas. And at the form body level, including the beatific body and the emanation bodies, they're each one individual. So they retain their continuum of the being that became a Buddha and became one with all the Buddhas, but they continue to enjoy being one with all the Buddhas, and they continue to do the work of all the Buddhas and in their individual capacity. So it's inconceivable in that, therefore, because it's contradictory in normal dualistic conceptions. Neither existing nor non-existing. So there, you know, what is the sense of existing as the opposite of non-existing? It's beyond either of those. It exists while not existing. It's non-existence while existing. It's awake and asleep at the same time, you know. That's the Dharmakaya, which is without any other basis. So it's not, it is everything, so it doesn't need any basis. You know, there's no basis of everything. Everything is itself everything, and things are based, and there are bases and things based on them within everything. But it itself is not a basis, and it doesn't have a basis. That's how it can be everything. You don't feel it the way they do. Luckily, you feel it in this inconceivable way without losing your bliss. But yet you completely feel it. And you feel its intolerability by them, so it's intolerable to you, even though intolerable is also blissful to you. I don't know, never mind. Free from attachment and non-attachment. So it's not aloof, and it's not stuck. Neither wisdom nor art, meaning exclusively just knowing, or exclusively just creating. I mean both of them, but he prefers to do neither nor here. That's the additional, and she says natural body or nature body, svabhavika kaya. And here, svabhava means nature or intrinsic reality, and svabhavika, long first it's called secondary derivative, it means nature-like. So natural, she makes it an adjective. That's okay. So that's the natural body. And that's really the Dharmakaya, but dividing the Dharmakaya into two, which is something indivisible, but you're dividing it conceptually into two to get a deeper feeling of its many aspects. So in other words, Pundarika first makes two verses on the Divine Lord as teaching, and then as four bodies, gives four verses, one on each of the four bodies. First Nirmanakaya, then Sambhogakaya, then Dharmakaya, then Svabhavikakaya.
Interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. To learn about special upcoming programs with Robert Thurman and friends at Tibet House US in New York City or at Menla Retreat in Phoenicia, New York, please visit bobthurman.com. This podcast was brought to you in part through the generous support of listeners like you and the Tibet House U.S. membership community. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Thanks for tuning in, and please be sure to like, subscribe, comment, and share on all your favorite social media platforms. Tashi Dalek, and hope to hear from you soon.